everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gorton Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gorton. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio, and it's heard off of Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gorton Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegorton.org. Again, that's georgegorton.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on water when we come back right after this. You know, with an income of $50,000, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed and pay 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 a second time? Now, you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of the $50,000 in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay the same 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. And that means that you're paying 17% of the $7,650 twice. Now, that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from every one of you who pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears, Penney's, or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? Now, isn't that just kind of special? Well, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gorton Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to my website. It's georgegorton.org. Again, that's georgegorton.org. Just click onto the email, send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegorton.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about water. I said that water, the world is running out of it. Water. We take it for granted. We all use it. We're made up of water. The population of the world has just about tripled over the last 60 years, and it's going to double in the next 30. We're going to need at least twice as much water over the next 30 years, or at least we're going to have to utilize twice as much water over the next 30 years to support 12 billion people as opposed to 6 billion people today. What are you going to do for your share of water? Today, when you turn on your water faucet, water comes out. Is it always going to be that way? And if it isn't, what are you doing today to provide for your water needs tomorrow? Most people don't spend much time thinking about it. But you know, only 1% of the water on planet Earth can be used by you and me. 99% of it is locked up. For instance, all the water that's in the oceans, it's not drinkable. You can't use it for irrigation. You can't use it for industry. And that represents 97% of the world's water sources. It's in the oceans, and it's salty, and it's unusable. 3% is fresh water. And get this, 67% of all the fresh water on planet Earth is locked up in ice on the polar ice caps, you know, such as Antarctica and Greenland and the North Pole. Now, that only leaves 1% of the world's water available for you and I to use. It's either in the aquifer under the ground, or it's in the river, or it's dropping on us out of the sky. That's the only source of water that we've got. The water under our feet that we pump out of the ground, the water that's running by us in the river, or the water that's falling on us out of the sky. That's where we, you and I, get our water. Now, I've got plenty of it, and I've made provisions for myself and my farm, and I can get by here. I don't need any outside water at all. Got it all. And I wanted to share this with you because, you know, you may be living in a desert region. You might be in Saudi Arabia, or maybe you're in a water short place. I was just out in Nevada not too long ago, and I watched the way they conserve water out there, and I was pretty impressed with what I saw. And I thought to myself, gee, I want to see if I can't share this with my listeners, because people have been living in arid regions for thousands of years, getting by quite nicely. Now we live in arid regions like the Los Angeles Basin, and we can't get by on the water that falls out of the sky or that fills the aquifer under the basin. We're bringing the water in from the Colorado River, and now that Colorado River has been used up. So when the population doubles again, you people aren't going to have enough water down there, and you're going to have high-priced water, water rationing and conservation. And you know there's a simple solution to that. You could prepare your own water. You could live on your own water. Yeah, I know it's a wild new concept, but let's take a look at some of these water problems. Ron Asherman could barely eke out a living raising melons, cucumbers, tomatoes, and other crops on his 300-acre Rocky Ford, Colorado farm. But quitting the business will earn him more than $1.2 million. Asherman and scores of other farmers on the high plains of southeastern Colorado are selling their water, which once produced melons, to the Denver suburbs of Aurora. Now, the prairie will retake the land that has long known the plow. Yeah, it's not a healthy thing to do for this area, but let me tell you, farming is not that great anymore, and these rural communities in almost any state you want to go into, they're all getting smaller, said Asherman, a 60-year-old farmer whose family has farmed in this area since 1911. The best dollar for the asset right now is the water. And the same thing is happening across the West as the nation's fastest-growing region shifts more water from farms to thirsty cities. Billions of gallons have changed hands last year in 8 Western states, and even more will flow in years to come. California recently approved a 75-year shift of water from desert farms to San Diego. It's the biggest transfer of its kind in U.S. history. Colorado's Arkansas River Valley serves as a cautionary example for the West's burgeoning water market. For a one-time payment of $18 million, Aurora bought water to flush toilets and grow flowers at new homes, and a faded farm region will be dealt another blow. What was once the pride of Rocky Ford, a 13-mile ditch that settlers dug by hand shortly after the Civil War, will be nearly drained. And when the water leaves, more jobs and local businesses are expected to dry up as well. West-wide, over the next 25 to 50 years, you will clearly see additional examples of what's happening in the Arkansas Valley. Now, Bennett Raley, a Denver water lawyer who is now the Bush administration's point man for Western water issues, is warning that over the next 25 to 50 years, what you have been seeing is going to be repeated over and over. And across the Arkansas River from Rocky Ford, Carl McClure, the 65-year-old resident, or president rather, of the local farmers union, offers a tour of what happened to a neighboring county that sold most of its water to Colorado Springs and other cities. Now, McClure noses his pickup past Crowley County's closed railroad stations, empty storefronts, and a shuttered car dealership. An alfalfa field has disappeared beneath the Arkansas Valley Correctional Facility, and McClure retired after working there 12 years to supplement his farm income. Now, this is what replaces farms when you take the water away, McClure said, gazing at the prison's floodlights and chain-link fence. Down the road is the newer Crowley County Correctional Facility. Together, the two prisons house more than 2,000 male inmates, nearly half the county's population and much of its growth. It can be very depressing, McClure said. Crowley County is a prime example of what shouldn't be happening. It is the fate that California's Imperial Valley, the state's poorest region, hopes to avoid. In October, the desert farm region, which uses more of Colorado River than most states, agreed to ship some of its supply to San Diego for $3.5 billion over the next 45 years. It's the biggest sale of its kind in U.S. history. Imperial found itself under extraordinary and unprecedented pressure to sell. You see, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation threatened to take away some water that it deemed the desert farmers were wasting. The water sale is designed to give Imperial and its $1 billion a year farm economy a measure of financial security. But many worry about the future of the valley tucked in California's southeastern corner. Valley farmers flood desert fields to produce huge amounts of alfalfa, a thirsty, low-value crop. The question on many minds is whether growers will be tempted to farm water rather than to farm the land. You see, it's much easier to go to the mailbox and pick up a check than it is to go out there and put in 60, 70, 80 hours a week growing alfalfa. So said John Pierre Menville. He's a third-generation farmer in Heber, California, who has been raising crops in the valley for 32 years. Farm towns in California have gone under when they lost their water to cities. The Owens Valley in the high desert east of the Sierra became a dust bowl when Los Angeles quietly acquired its water and then flushed it down an aqueduct to the city 90 years ago. The 1974 film Chinatown was loosely based on what's been dubbed the water grab. "Whoever brings the water brings the people," wrote William Mulholland, the aqueduct's legendary creator. Modern day water speculators still stalk the waterways of the West. Denver investors bought up Rocky Ford sugar beet refinery and then sold the water associated with it to Aurora 20 years ago. Then, a decade later, brothers Lee and Edward Bass, oil barons from Fort Worth, quietly bought up Imperial Valley land and then tried unsuccessfully to sell the water out from under it. Recently, another Arkansas Valley canal has attracted interest from investors in Denver and New Orleans. So what's the answer for the 450,000 farms in the West, squeezed by rising equipment costs, depressed crop prices, and brutal drought? Farmers are finding it harder to hang on, and farms use as much as 95% of the water in some areas of the West. Growing cities will continue nibbling away at agriculture's share. And many believe that water markets offer a way to get water to cities without completely wiping out the farms. So over the past decade, Northern California's rice farmers have sold smaller stakes of their sizable water supply to Los Angeles over the years. Instead of viewing it as a threat to their survival, growers say selling water offers them a financial cushion if the price of rice collapses. I truly believe that it could be a beneficial part of a farmer's mix at a small level, said rice grower Don Bransford. Similarly, a market has evolved for water from the massive Colorado Big Thompson Project, which brings water over and through the Rockies to northeastern Colorado through a series of dams, tunnels, and pipes. Cities have paid as much as 6 cents a gallon for Big Thompson water. Some of the states and the West's highest prices, 6 cents a gallon for water. Towns in Texas lease large amounts of Rio Grande water through well-functioning markets. Developers have set up a system to buy Truckee River water for new homes in and around Reno, Nevada. And Albuquerque, New Mexico, has been buying up middle Rio Grande water rights from farmers, according to the water strategist, a Claremont, California publication that tracks sales of water. Brent M. Haddon, the associate professor of environmental studies at the University of California in Santa Cruz and the author of Rivers of Gold, takes a different view of water markets. "The bell tolls when you create water markets because all this is going to do is shrink the number of farms," Haddon said, "and what we're talking about is a means of moving from farms to cities. Now turn on the tap in Aurora and out comes water that once grew crops. Three-fourths of the water that helped the sprawling suburb east of Denver vault into the ranks of Colorado's biggest cities has been acquired from farmers. And over the past decade, most of the city's new water has come from the Arkansas River Valley, according to Doug Kemper, Aurora's water resources manager. Once the Rocky Ford water sale is approved by a judge, water that once flowed on the Ackerman or Asherman's farm for three generations will start flowing into the city. They're going to drink it. They're going to have parks. They're going to grow flowers. They're going to have baseball diamonds and football fields. They're going to have all those things, Asherman said. And when you can't make it on the farm, what else are you to do? Now, water has become a high-dollar profit item. In fact, we call it the water grab. And there is a water grab by the federal government out in the western rangelands because everyone sees what's coming. The population is going to double over the next 30 years. And when it does, the need for water is going to double. And where is the water needed? In the cities. Of course, I don't know what you people are going to eat, but no matter what it is you're going to eat, you're going to have water in your cities to wash your cars and to grow grass in your lawns so that you can go to the job, and you'll have to have industrial water to work at the plant and the factory that is turning out the industrial goods and so on. Indeed, the population of the world is growing to an unmanageable level. Not unmanageable because the world can't sustain a population of 12, 24, 36, 48, or 60 billion people. It has before. But you see, we humans have not dressed and kept our garden very well, and we have steadily created bigger and bigger deserts like the Sahara, the Gobi. And now on our western Great Plains, we're suffering a great drought. Are these droughts man-made? Are they caused by God to punish us? Is there a combination of the two? What's happened to all the waters and all the rivers? Where have they all gone? Have we mismanaged them in such a way that we're the proximate cause of our own injury? Well, the following is an excerpt from Rivers of Life, Managing Water for People and Nature by Sandra Postel and Brian Richter. Now, the authors argue that humanity has done great damage to the environment by altering the world's rivers to suit exclusively human purposes. Ironically, many of these changes have simultaneously weakened the river's inherent capacity to perform tasks that benefit humanity naturally. Where have all the rivers gone? Well, many rivers around the world, large and small, are drying up before they reach their natural destinations. In addition to the Colorado River, five of the largest rivers in Asia, the Ganges, the Indus, the Yellow, the Amu Darya, and the Sardarya, no longer reach the sea for large portions of the year. Channelized rivers, such as the Rhine in Europe and a large stretch of the Missouri in the United States Midwest, no longer meander, but rather they flow artificially, straight and deep, to allow for the shipping and the barging of goods. Levees have disconnected the mighty Mississippi River from 90% of its floodplain. Societies have reaped substantial economic rewards from these modifications to rivers, from the generation of hydroelectric power to the expansion of irrigated agriculture to the growth of trade along shipping routes. But serious losses have mounted on the ecological side of the register. In their natural state, healthy rivers perform myriad functions, such as purifying water, moderating floods and droughts, and maintaining habitat for fisheries, birds, and wildlife. They connect the continental interiors with the coasts, bringing sediments to the deltas, delivering nutrients to the coastal fisheries, and maintaining salinity balances that sustain productive estuaries. From source to the sea and from channel to floodplain, these river ecosystems gather, store, and move snowmelt and rainwater in symphony with nature's cycles. The diversity and the abundance of life in running waters reflect millions of years of evolution and adaptation to these natural rhythms. From a strictly human perspective, healthy rivers perform numerous ecosystem services. The process is carried out by natural ecosystems that benefit human societies and economies. Rivers, wetlands, and other freshwater ecosystems constitute part of the natural infrastructure that keeps our economies humming, like workers in a factory, Wetland plants and animals are an organized and productive team, absorbing pollutants, decomposing wastes, churning out fresh, clean water. And even if we knew how to replicate all of the valuable functions that rivers perform, it would cost an enormous sum to replace them. The services provided by wetlands alone can be worth on the order of $20,000 per hectare per year. Now, that's about $8,000 an acre. Now, notice that these people are talking about millions of years. You know, as old Carl Sagan used to say, billions and billions of years. I think if we went back about 4,300 years, we'd come to Noah's flood, and that's the beginning of our ecological systems. And God told us 1,600 years before that to dress and keep the garden. Now, I don't know how well we dressed and kept the garden prior to the flood, but after the flood, we started off with 8 people. And with only 8 people in the world, there wasn't much of an ecological problem. The natural processes developed. The Mississippi River developed its delta, and the Colorado River flowed all the way to the Gulf of California, and it produced a delta, and there were no problems. Now, from those 8 people have now developed 6 billion of us, and we're about to turn into 12 billion over the next 30 years. And this poses a problem for me. I want to stake out my place in the sun, and I want to get my share of the water. After all, I need water for my cattle and for my house, and so I have some water projects on my farm, my place. I'm not going to sell my water, and if I do, then I'm going to sell water, not water rights. I might bottle it, and I might ship it off and sell it because I do have a surplus of it. But out in the West, people are selling their water rights and then moving to the cities. This disenfranchises and divests their children for future generations of their inheritance. I don't want to dismiss the inheritance from my children. I think that it's of value to pass on what we create and produce to the next generation and to the next generation. But you know, there's 15 laws that had we followed these 15 agricultural laws, we would not have the problems that we're following today. And I'm not talking about the Congress or the President or some ecological problem that can be solved by the United Nations. I'm talking about individuals being taught and trained out of the Scripture in the basic laws that govern the planet. You know, that's what the Law Hour is all about. I have been involved in legal battles. There is natural law, there is scriptural law, and there is secular or Roman civil law. And all law governs everything that we do. It's the most important aspect of life. It's like going to Flo's Whorehouse. There are laws that are in force and effect. Venereal disease, AIDS, herpes, venereal warts, and all of the STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, are governed by law. Knowing what those laws are, where the lines are drawn in the sand, is what keeps you healthy and happy and productive. Breaking those laws cause penalties that cause death, sickness. The same thing is true here with natural laws that affect the water and the water table. You know, there's only so much water in the Ogla-Ogla aquifer. And when you pump the water out in these circle pivot irrigation systems to grow corn, to sell for dollars, to put on your bank ledger statements, every gallon you pump out has to be replaced by the natural system that replenishes it. And right now we're pumping out 2 gallons for every gallon that naturally replaces it. So at some point in time, it's going to be pumped dry. Try it. Just take a jar and fill it up with jelly beans. Take 2 out and put 1 in. Take 2 out and put 1 in. Take 2 out and put 1 in. And at some point in time, that jar is going to be totally devoid of jelly beans. They'll all be pumped out. I mean, you don't have to go to college to figure that out now, do you? So when God told us that he was going to give us rain in due season, it was predicated upon the practice of these agricultural laws, these 15 agricultural laws. So when you experience a drought, and in this case, a drought over an entire region, the western United States, and they tell us these droughts are periodic, and they've been going on for millions and millions of years. Now, if that's true, then God lied to you. It's just that simple. Then he's not the producer of rain in due season. Rain comes at periodic times, and there are droughts at periodic times, and it's all random chance, and it happens by accident. And there's no design, there's no God, and the scripture is a lie. Now, that's scenario number one. Now, scenario number two is there is a God, and God controls the weather. He controls the planet. In fact, he even goes a little bit further. He says, the earth is my footstool. He says, I own this piece of real estate over here. And we came along and said, oh no, I own this piece of real estate, and the prima facie evidence of it is my tax receipt. You see, I pay property tax on it, and therefore I'm going to use this land any way I want to. And so we've been doing that, and it worked out well for a long time, but now the population has grown, and as the population has grown, we find that the people in the cities outnumber the people out here in the countryside. Congress has enabled or has established certain policies concerning agricultural goods, and farm prices are pretty low, and the value of the water is pretty high. And these policies that are created create the environment for which these farmers are selling their water rights, to these burgeoning suburbs for temporary economic growth. Now, let's just think this through for a minute. If Aurora ran out of water and they needed to go to Rocky Ford to buy their water, well then, what are they going to do when Aurora grows to double its present size? They've used up all the water in Rocky Ford. Then what are they going to do? Well, I guess they'll go someplace else and buy some more water. Okay. And as they keep buying up all of the water to make this city grow bigger and bigger, what are they going to do when they have bought up all the water in all of the surrounding counties so that they can grow lawns and flowers and put water in the taps of your suburban homes? Has anybody ever thought ahead 30, 60, 100 years and said, gee, at some point in time we're going to run out of water, or we're going to run out of food, or we're going to run out of water and food? You see, cities over a million people are economically unsustainable. New York City, if you severed it from New York State, would starve to death. It requires the suburbs, it requires the rural communities to provide the food, the fuel, the fiber, the raw materials for that city to survive. The policy seems to be to move all the people off the land and into the city. Now, that's called the ninth plank to the Communist Manifesto. God had a little different plan. His plan was to establish you in the land and to keep you on the land forever. Cities should be small, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 people, and the people should be basically living in the land, on the land. And you should be receiving rain in due season, and everybody should be growing food, you know, the Bible in an obscure old-timey prophetic book called Isaiah pictures a man sitting under his vine and fig tree, living happily ever after, kind of like the Garden of Eden. I live in the Garden of Eden here. My wife Jackie and I go out and have breakfast. We go out and get underneath a mulberry tree and we just eat our breakfast right off the tree. Or we go down to the garden and we just pick tomatoes and eat them, and peppers, and eat them out of the garden. It's just kind of fun thinking about how Adam and Eve used to live, walking around in the garden, they're feeling a little hungry, reach up and pull down a peach, and reach up and pull down a papaya, or pull a carrot out of the ground and kind of munch and eat and live their lives and kind of had a good time. It seems to me that that's what people really want, and they go to the city so they can earn the money to come back into the country so that they can buy the Garden of Eden so that they can live happily ever after. Made me kind of wonder, well, why did you leave the country to go to the city in the first place? But, you know, people are people, aren't they? I don't think that it's very well thought out. I don't think people are thinking ahead 20, 30, 50, 100 years. They didn't think ahead 20, 30, 50, or 100 years, 20, 30, 50, or 100 years ago, now did they? Otherwise, we wouldn't have the water problem we have today, would we? So therefore, my common sense says that George Gordon better solve his water problem today, because 30 years from now, the water problem is going to be twice as bad as it is today. And keep in mind that socialist governments have a habit of just going out and taking what they want. You saw that at Waco and Ruby Ridge, didn't you? Hey, hang on, we got to take a little break here. We'll be right back with more on Where Have All the Rivers Gone when we return. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Hey, you know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it. A Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax all of us, and they tax everything and anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that the government does to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38 cents for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on the pizza that they buy the ingredients to make, prepare, cook, serve, pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Is that what their share is? 38%? Now, why does the government get paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? Well, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School on CD discs, compact discs. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Tax and Status, that's my school, is also available on compact disc for home education. That's not free. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free, remember that's free, general law CD package. And you can do that right now. Just get on the email machine by going to georgegordon.org. Click onto that email, send me an email request, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, where have all the rivers gone? In little more than a century, a geologic twinkling of an eye, you can tell these boys here are all humanistic evolutionary philosophers, aren't they? In little more than a century, a geologic twinkling of an eye, human societies have so altered rivers that they are no longer adequately performing many of their evolutionary roles or delivering many of the ecological services that human economies have come to depend upon. I think that's why God created the rivers the way they are, where they're at, and told us to dress and keep the garden. I know it's a wild new concept, dress and keep the garden. A significant portion of freshwater species worldwide, including at least 20% of the freshwater fish species, are at risk of extinction or are already extinct. And that's because floodwaters are no longer getting cleansed by floodplain wetlands, and more pollution is reaching inland and coastal seas, causing damage such as the low oxygen dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and the deterioration of Europe's Black Sea. In short, in many parts of the world, the harnessing of rivers for economic gain is now causing more harm than good. Now, up in the Andes Mountains is a unique story concerning the water and what the alpacas to the rescue, Ecuadorians and heifer work to preserve delicate Andean zone and water supply. Now, let me show you a little something here that you can do for yourself. I can't control the neighbors around me, but I can sure control myself. I can do my part. I know the law, and I can do my part of the law to provide for and to protect water and water quality on my farm. I can do my part to educate others to do their part and their share. Now, I'm sure that HEFR, and I'm sure the United Nations and Congress and the United States government and all of its ministries and all of its secretaries are well-meaning people, and they would certainly like to solve the water problem. But I'm not sure that any of them know the laws that are required that we all have to follow in order to solve that problem. So I'm going to do my little part, and I'm not sure that anybody's going to listen, and I'm not sure that anybody's going to do anything about it. But I'm going to tell you what the laws are and how this works and why it works that way and what the results are that you can expect if you follow these 15 agricultural laws. And if you don't, well, then there's a penalty to pay. And I'm more convinced that the world is going to pay the penalty than they are that they're going to solve the problem or reap the benefits. But you need to know what the outcome is going to be. And then if you don't take some kind of corrective action, then in law we call it, you then become the proximate cause of your own injury. I don't want to be the proximate cause of my own injury, so I think that I'm going to do something to solve my water problem, and I want to do it right now. Now, here's a simple formula that is going on up in the Andes, high, high up in the mountains. Now, up in Latacunga, Ecuador, in the shadow of the snow-crested Chimborazo volcano, a very unlikely hero, the alpaca, has stepped in to save a fragile high-altitude environmental zone, a vital water source for farms, villages, towns, and cities down below. HEFR International is working with Ecuadorian indigenous communities in the Andes to preserve the zone from destruction by farming and sheep grazing. With help from HEFR, communities are raising alpacas in the zone known as the Paramo. Our intention in having a project with HEFR is to recover what we've lost in water resources, said Demirio Tipan. He's the president of a grassroots organization of rural Andean communities near Latacunga. That's Latacunga. So if I'm butchering your town's name, please forgive me. Latacunga, about 60 miles south of Quito, Ecuador. The Paramo's delicate spongy ground cover is vital to the intricate ecology that supplies water to the ecosystems and human communities downhill. These plants soak up snowmelt and abundant rainwater, feeding underground springs that flow into streams and rivers. The farms, towns, and cities at the lower elevations rely on this Paramo water as a primary source. But farming and grazing in this Paramo disrupts this natural system. Farmers' plows and the sheep's hard cloven hooves damage the ground cover. In addition, hungry sheep munch the low-growing plants down to the bare ground, destroying the system's ability to collect water and causing soil erosion. Well, unlike sheep, alpacas have soft padded feet, and the indigenous people have been forced into the high-altitude Paramo because of population pressures, poverty, and the sparse availability of land. Now, they would normally farm and raise livestock in the middle and lower elevations that are more tolerant of human activity. So said Fernando Larrera. He's HEFR's Ecuador director. Communities taking part in the HEFR initiative have jointly own the HEFR-supplied alpacas, sell valuable yarn and knit sweaters, ponchos, and other items through small businesses that they've set up. This income helps relieve the poverty that pushes indigenous peoples into the Paramo in the first place, Loria said. Now, the benefit of the alpaca is that it produces wool and its hooves do not destroy the Paramo. Manure from the alpacas is composted and used as fertilizer to improve topsoil in the middle elevation farms. And what we're trying to do is to have a better life for our brothers and sisters. Our goal is to improve the community and household life conditions, says Tiepen. Heifer's Jim DeVries said water is becoming an increasingly important part of livestock and agroecology projects around the world. And water is becoming a more precious resource around the world, he said, from the standpoint of food security and health. Water is a huge issue. Heifer concentrates on providing livestock and environmental protection to resource-poor communities around the world. But as in Ecuador, preservation of water supplies and efficient irrigation methods are often important ingredients in Heifer's work, DeVries said. Small-scale farmers frequently have a keen awareness of water resources. There is a motivation that you can build on. When you get people organized, they start to envision a better situation for themselves and their families, and they start to act on it, DeVries said. Alpacas were once a common sight in the Ecuador Andes, but over time they vanished, and no one is exactly sure as to why. But in the past, alpacas lived in Ecuador, but the alpacas disappeared from Ecuador in the colonial times in the 17th and 18th centuries. There are different hypotheses about why they disappeared, and some believe the alpacas died out from a disease brought in by the Spanish. Others say that they disappeared because the Spanish prohibited the use of alpacas because they were associated with indigenous religions. Heifer is now helping to reintroduce them. In turn, the graceful, placid alpacas are helping to save the paramo. Now, I'm going to pause there for a moment. Let me make an observation. Remember what I said earlier here in our local area. This region, about 40,000 square miles of real estate, was covered by hardwood forests. After the Civil War, the building of the railroads produced great economic value in the timber over this region. So, the timber barons moved in and clear-cut all of this region off. I mean, they just took everything off. I've seen pictures from the 1920s through the 1940s, and this place looks like a moonscape. Not exactly dressing and keeping the garden, would you say? There were handsome profits to be made, but we decided handsome wasn't enough. So lust and greed took over, and we clear-cut it all. Now, at the time, the rainfall here was up around 60 to 80 inches, nearly double what it is today. The rainfall here is recovering, believe it or not, in spite of the deprivations that we see going on today, but there was 2 feet of topsoil. Now, I'm standing on land here in the Ozarks, Ozark County, in which there isn't even 1 inch of topsoil. When you drive across this ground 50 times, you got a road. This is clay and gravel. This is clay and rock. If you want topsoil here, you truck it in. Now, there was 2 feet of topsoil in 1880. Today, there is 1 inch. Now, what happened to our topsoil? Well, they clear-cut the trees. Without the trees, the rains came down and washed the topsoil away. Our topsoil sits south of New Orleans today, out in the Delta. Not exactly what you'd call dressing and keeping the garden, now, was it? Well, meanwhile, the government came in, stopped these logging practices. Of course, there wasn't any more trees to cut, and so there wasn't much to change. Today, there is second-growth hardwood forest over most of the region. Farmers around here now, in order to figure out, well, what am I going to do, bulldoze down these second-growth trees, scrub oak, and plant grass so that they can raise cattle. Across the road from me is a fellow who had 320 acres. And he was carrying about 100 head of beef cows and producing about 100 calves a year. And every year he'd go out there and he'd take another 10 or 15 acres and he'd bulldozer down, deck it up, burn it, plant grass. And he kept doing that year after year until he cleared off the 320 acres, about a half a square mile. Today, there are no cattle. It's all cleared and starting to grow up again to brush. Here's what happened. When he cut off all the tree's roots hold the water, the moisture, the grain in the ground, and the canopy of the trees keep the sun off of the ground. By keeping the sun off the ground, the mulch on the ground holds the moisture in the ground and you have natural springs. He doesn't have any natural springs on his 320 acres. You see, he destroyed all the springs when he destroyed the forest. So by destroying the forest, he destroyed the springs. When he destroyed the springs, he has no water. No water to feed his livestock. He can't have cows without water, so he's got grass with no water. So he had to sell the cows or truck in the water. In fact, it's so bad across the road that they've got a well over there that barely produces enough for two houses. Two houses, his mother and his family. So he works in the city to make a living. His wife also works. They, in short, are divorcing themselves from the land. They are turning the land into a desert. Now, they didn't do it intentionally. They meant well. They're hard-working people. But they went to the public school, and the public school taught them about eons of time and millions of years, and they taught them about modern economics and paper money. They didn't learn about unjust weights and balances in Leviticus 19, 35, and 36. They didn't learn about land Sabbaths and Jubilees. They didn't learn about the agricultural laws of the Scripture. And because they're ignorant of law, they violated laws which in turn have natural penalties. I'm not telling you anything that's new here. You see, around here, when you have a spring, you never cut the trees around the spring. Because if you do, the spring will dry up. Now, I don't know what the scientific reason for that is. I just know that the old-timers around here have been telling me and explaining it to me, and they would point out that down here at this spring, the guy came in there, they used to call them outsiders, and so he thought he'd cut the trees down around the spring, and he did, and the spring went dry. Now, whether the roots kept the spring passages open, I don't know. There's something that goes on there, the live trees around the spring keep the spring flowing. This guy didn't do that, and the springs dried up. And, of course, old Everett Chisholm, he's about 85 years old now. He's an old-timer, and he learned that from his daddy, who learned it from his daddy, who was an old Cherokee Indian. Somehow, these old-timers knew and understood those laws that we, the younger generation that go to the ag schools, don't seem to grasp or comprehend. So across the road is 320 acres. Now, that 320 acres... will go back to forest, it'll go back to scrub, and at some point in time the springs will start to flow again, and there will be a mixture of grass and a scrub, and then somebody will come in there and say, well, gee, we got to clean this place up, and they'll do, and they'll shut the springs off again, just like Dale did, and we'll repeat the cycle. Or, in North Africa, where the Romans cut off all the trees, they're replanting the trees. And along the coast, along the Mediterranean coast of North Africa, they've been planting trees. Now they've got trees about 30 miles wide. And the more trees they plant, the more rainfall they're experiencing. You see, the rainfall is going up along the north coast of Africa from Egypt to Morocco. Now, we found out that when we cut the trees down, we get less and less rain. And when we plant more trees, we get more and more rain. You know, we could have got that right out of the Bible. We would have got that right out of dressing and keeping the garden. We weren't paying attention, and we've created millions of square miles of desert that we really need today to feed 12 billion people. And you know, if we hadn't turned the Gobi Desert into a desert and the Sahara Desert into a desert, we instead now would have another 6 million square miles of land like the Midwestern United States, which would support another 6 billion people. Did you ever stop to think about that? Now, the people in the Sahara, the sub-Sahara, are cutting their trees down. Don't you think that we could do more good by going to those people and educating them? Because if you cut your trees down, you're going to have less and less rain. And isn't that what your problem is right now? Don't you think we should be planting more and more trees rather than cutting more and more down? Now, up here in the Andes, the natural use of this land at the high elevations was for alpacas. The Spaniards came in and said, no, we're going to replace those with sheep and cattle. You know, we've done that here in Ozark County. This is not the natural place to be raising sheep and cattle. The natural place to raise sheep and cattle is out in Kansas and Nebraska, on the plains where there's grass. This is the place that we should be raising trees. This is the place where we should have forests. Yes, we need some meadows, and yes, we need some cattle, and yes, we need some farmland, but there's plenty of it here. We call these hollers down here. They're actually hollows or little valleys where the streams run through. There's plenty of land here. Then we decided that we needed Bull Shoals Lake. So we built Bull Shoals Dam, and we inundated all of the hollows. Now we're up here clearing the ridges off of the forests so that we can grow grass to replace what we lost under the dam, under the lake. Maybe we would have been better off if we'd have built a number of smaller dams and preserved the hollows so that we could use the water in the hollows so that we could grow the grass in the hollows instead of covering it up with the lake. Now, certainly, we do have hydroelectric power. That's true. And besides the hydroelectric power, we've also got water skiing, and we've got resorts, and we've got industrialization. But we also have higher and higher population densities, and we're back to where we started our conversation. Do you remember? Troubled waters. You see, there's only 1% of the water on planet Earth that's usable. And I guess the question arises, how do we want to use it? You want to use it wisely, individually. Now let's take a look at what these people are doing up here in the Andes. Small farmers up in the Andes, can they solve the problem, or do we need multinational corporate farmers like ADM and Cargill and a super socialist welfare state in the form of Congress and the Department of Interior and the Forest Service to solve it for us? Well, they say, in turn, the graceful placid alpacas are helping to save the paramo, or the paramo, P-A-R-A-M-O, I would say that's paramo. The alpacas are also helping to beautify the countryside because they're so beautiful, joked Heifer Ecuador's Edwin Chansquig. The alpaca's look alike cousin is the llama. The llama also bears fiber, but is rarely used for clothing. The alpaca's fiber is more valuable. Now, the shortage of land for these indigenous people has its roots in the colonial system that allowed gentry to take over huge tracts of highly productive land for haciendas. Oh, you see, that's a violation of the land law. You see, God told us to go out and claim all the land that we could use, occupy, and possess. Now, we don't want to practice that law, we decided. What we want is to create these huge corporate farms. So, 100, 200, 300 years ago, we were doing the same thing. We just called them Spanish land grants. Today, we call it corporate agribusiness. It's where we put the aggregate amount of thousands of acres of land under the ownership of one person or a collective. And then we employ all the people to be peons on the land. We call them employees today. And then we lock them up in villages or cities. We call those suburbs, like Aurora, Colorado. You know, all we've accomplished here is that we have changed the names. Instead of haciendas, we now have corporate agri-farms, industrial agribusiness. And it's producing a water problem because now you've got twice, three times, four times the population. Well, this forced the indigenous people into marginal lands higher up. Acres of greenhouses for the flower industry at lower elevations have added to the land shortage. In recent years, Ecuador's indigenous groups have pushed for redistribution of the hacienda land and for a more equitable distribution of the water from the Paramo. Economic considerations have forced indigenous families to seek work outside their villages so that they can send money home. Some work in the flower industry. Others toil in menial jobs in the big cities of Quito and Guayaquil. Still others head east to Ecuador's Amazon region to work in the oil fields, or they come north to the United States as illegal immigrants. Still others go as far as Spain and Italy to work, and we're trying to create less dependence on these external sources of income. The availability of water often determines whether a family can stay on its small parcel of land, Tippin said, and you can't talk about the family economy without talking about the water, he said, and we're now concentrating on preserving the Paramo and its natural resources, especially water, so that our families have something to eat and something to drink. Now, you'll notice that they're talking about small acreages of 5 acres. Now, have you heard me talk about making $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less? Sounds pretty wild, doesn't it? Well, if we could make $100,000 on 25 acres or less, let's just take $100,000 and let's divide that by 5, and wouldn't that be $20,000 a year on 5 acres? You know, there are people that are making $100,000 a year on as little as 3 acres. You know, 3 acres of raspberries at $43,000 an acre is pretty good money. I mean, it gets right up there with marijuana and cocaine poppies, doesn't it? Or cocaine and opium poppies. And that's my point. It isn't how much land you have, it's how you use it. And these people have never been taught the 15 agricultural laws. They've been taught Roman Catholicism. They've been taught socialism and communism, but nobody's ever taught them the laws that regulate the use of the land. And here they are, developing haciendas of thousands of acres and forcing the poor people up into the higher elevations on 5 acres where they can't make it with sheep, goats, and cows. Well, that's right. And the people that have sheep, goats, and cows out in Chad and Niger and the other places in Sub-Sahara can't make it either. And that's because they're in violation of basic laws. They don't get rain in due season. They've got a water shortage that they could solve no matter whether you're living in the Amazon rainforest, where we have cut the rainfall down by 25% over the last 40 years, or whether you're living in the desert where you didn't have that rain to start with. But you know, people can live in the desert, they can live in the rainforest. But if you don't follow the laws, you will turn the rainforest into a desert. I would contend that it's time to make a change. But we'll take that up next time, right here on the Law Hour. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour has been brought to you by the Gordon Law School as an educational service in the public interest. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law Hour and the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD set for your copy. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. All right, we'll see you next time, same station, right here. Thanks for listening.